Is he PJ? Is he PJ almost spinning out?
I bought it at Costco, so it's not $2. We're much more economical. And yeah, my job during this is just to keep myself from laughing.
Welcome back to the Design System Office Hours podcast. It's Wednesday afternoon in early summer. That's what it feels like right now. It's 87 degrees where I'm at here.
Hot.
In Northern California.
Been in the Bay Area. Anything that's out of the range of between 74 and 76 is, like 68 and 72 is not tolerable.
Yeah, in the Bay Area, when you get to the 80s, y'all cry global warming. So
I do.
Pretty true.
Yeah.
Yeah. So today we have an interesting topic. So this is episode 10, I believe. And we're looking to talk about what you wish you would have knew when you had started this design system journey at Pinterest, or at, in my case, at Disney Streaming, or, you know, at any other place of work that you've done. And really, like, we do talk a lot about if I would have known, or if this technology would have been a little more easy to use, or if this app had this sort of feature. We talk a lot of theoreticals in that sense. So I just wanted to talk to you, PJ, about in your journey there, or maybe even in your journey working here at Disney Streaming, what are some things that you wish you would have known when you'd gotten started?
Yeah, I can start way, way back when I worked on the first design systems, when I was a little babby, when I was considerably younger and definitely had a different view on how to make software. And this whole design systems thing was popping up, and it was like a friggin' kid in a candy shop, building all these components, doing all these things, adding all this stuff, and learned really quickly, like, at how systems are exponential. And, you know, the more you add, the more complexity you inject into the system, and the harder it is to maintain. And so far and away, and the thing that probably is still with me the most, is how much restraint is a valuable quality within systems, and the less you can add, the less gray hairs you'll have, you know, a few months down the road.
Yeah, one of the talking points in a presentation, I think by the time this may air, it may be around the time where I may be making this presentation. I'm doing a presentation at a conference, UXDX, about design systems and design delivery. And one of the things that I talk about is that you could start anywhere. So, like, imagine in the day we were federated designers at Disney Streaming maintaining this component library, and we don't need much to really start aligning. So, like, in our case, I do wish that we aligned across all three of the platforms that we supported. So mobile, web, and living room. Instead, we had, I think very, very common with other folks in the industry, we had a specific type ramp and color ramp that was for mobile and living room. The typography was, I would say, more different based on sizing and that sort of thing. The colors were mostly the same, with just different values for television, for, you know, lower resolution and such. But if we were able to think about this, the future of just a unified type ramp back then, that would have been something that would have, like, brought design tokens into fruition much sooner. And even thinking about things like using it just for web only, maybe just thinking about it in SaaS only, that would have also brought us into design tokens faster.
Yeah. And not only that, but let's say you have a type ramp of like 30 sizes, which is a lot. If you put yourself in the place of a product designer that has to look at that and try to figure out how to use it, when do I use the 25th sized typeface for type size versus 26? Like, there's a lot of area for ambiguity and complexity, and, like, I have no idea how to use this right. The simpler you make it, theoretically at least, the easier you understand. Everything has its use, very clear, hopefully, or clearer at least, and just easier to wrap your head around. I do remember this one system I worked on had a type ramp of 4 sizes, It had 8 colors. And because we had the luxury of it was focused on tooling, where we didn't need a lot of visual flair, and it was really easy to understand how to use each size and each color, because there wasn't a lot to choose from. Some people understandably don't like that because it doesn't give them a lot of options. I tend to really like it because it's a constraint. You try to think creatively around that constraint and focus on other stuff. But I think that is controversial topic, divisive maybe among designers.
Yeah, that's such an interesting concept. Just thinking about using 5 or, you know, as a number, like maybe to start with 5 type sizes, 5 brand colors, absent of utility colors, 5 units of measure. So 4 times whatever. It does greatly simplify things. And it does remind me of designing a bit for Roku devices, which in terms of like hard drive space is fairly minimal. So they do require us to think about a minimal amount of font faces, preferably 1 to 2. And in the case that we had tried to, you know, use 1, they're really looking at using as few font sizes as possible, no weight changes. If we're thinking about this from like a constraint-based model and adding guardrails, it does help you really, if you're able to start from that in a very clean slate, I think you'd be able to think about these sort of additions more meaningfully, intentionally.
Yeah, it's. I think that is a topic in and of itself. The exponentiality of design systems, which would be a fun topic to cover down the road, because you can get in really deep of, you know, how much complexity you inject by just adding, you know, 5 colors to your color palette. Just that can start to really grow the amount of combinations that you could see, color combinations you can see within the product really quickly. Kind of staggering, actually, if you dig into it. So it might be a fun topic for another week.
Yeah, that'd be a good one. Yeah. One of the other things that I would think back that would have helped get even better adoption is better documentation, whether that's in on a reference site or just inside the tool itself. I think we could do a lot of goodwill by just documenting usage patterns alongside some of this stuff. So like if you're in a Figma frame, having a frame next to it just talking about like how this thing may be compiled, maybe even show if you do have code generated components, reference components that these are like, you know, related to, and then really talk about the anatomy of how something is built, explaining how something is built and how components are compiled to be, you know, molecules, for instance, I think really showcases the flexibility of a lot of the work that we do. Even I noticed when we've explained some of like the theming exercises that we've done from one app to another app, and showcasing that, you know, with this unified token layer, if we keep the token names the same, the semantic token names, you'd be able to do now with the technology, just library swaps that could just swap from one theme to another. So that was one thing, you know, 3 years ago, did not exist in the apps themselves, like the library swapping, but that's been extremely helpful to showcase the power of a lot of this stuff.
When do you think that realization came to be during your time at Disney?
Barely, like I would say barely late. Like we were so laser focused on shipping one app, so Disney Plus, and that's most people's problem, design problem, working on Pinterest app or working on, you know, Peacock, Netflix. Like it's a singular app. And when you add different modes to it, say like a kids mode, that's when we started to think about using the same semantic naming for a kids theme. So we did have that hint, but we never thought that we would be able to extend this to a multi-platform. And maybe it was just that our minds were not, you know, awoken of that, and we really didn't understand how far we could extend this.
Yeah, it's kind of bonkers if you can set the right foundation, just how far these kind of systems can take you. But it's, you know, it ain't easy. That foundation takes a really long time. And then getting the buy-in to invest the time in that foundation is also can be a challenge, right? Because it's not one day we may potentially need this thing. Like, that's not typically how roadmaps are working. It's, you know, solve this fire right now. But if you can build in that foundation, it really, boy, it can really put your mind at ease when that unknown thing comes down the road, which is typically pretty inevitable.
Well, one other thing that I think a lot about is trying to do more training and getting more advocates earlier on than we did. So then in the sort of last iteration of our design systems team, we did have, you know, the luxury to switch tools, to switch to Figma. So that did bring a built-in mechanism to engage with designers on a one-on-one basis, do design systems related training. If we were able to do that with our, you know, previous tool stack with Sketch, Abstract, Yuck, and Zeppelin. Abstract really the only one that is more of the Yuck. We would have gotten a lot more contributions, and we would have gotten a lot more designers working with us versus sort of waving the flag delivering the dump truck of handoff, you know, to our team.
What do you think was the biggest win? The most effective type of training that you employed?
Oh, by far, office hours. And you know, that's why like the name of our podcast is that. And I hold it, you know, dear to our heart, because it's a one-on-one engagement with feature owners and designers across org. And the nature of our office hours being drop-in during a set amount of time, we used to, at the most, we've had them twice a week, but it's a drop-in time. You don't have to sign up, meaning I think the benefit of that is you never know who's going to be there. You won't see Sally's going to be dropping in on office hours. She's going to be presenting on this. I think that did provide a lot of pressure. Like if you do have a sign up, because then people get that so-and-so is signing up and they want to be able to come and pounce and give feedback. But that's not what this is about. This is just about supporting other designers. And it's the great benefit of this was that it's designers talking to other designers. I was a manager on the team, so I was the only manager that was there, really just facilitating. But there were no DPMs there. There were no senior managers, no directors, like no one there to ask you, when will you have this thing done? So it's really an open space, and designers really got a lot out of that. Just breaking pixels.
Breaking pixels. I haven't heard that term before. The thing I've always been trying to figure out is how to have something like office hour scale, because I'm a big fan of one-on-one engagements. It's just, how do you do that with a lot of peeps? And where does that information flow, and how does it get shared out? I mean, you know, there are answers to all these things, but it's a lot of work, right? And that's the thing that I've been struggling with. It's just, it's a lot of hours necessary to make this happen. And how do you do it in a way that's a little bit easier on folks, to where it's not a huge burden?
Yeah. That wraps with one of the other realizations that I wish our organization understood early on, is that design systems isn't component libraries. It is comprised of component libraries. It's some fuzzy percentage, right? So like an easy non-controversial one is that I say that it's 50% component libraries, 50% community and engagement. Non-controversial, but it really is something more about the engagement and advocacy of said thing, and making sure that the thing governs itself. We're able to utilize and flex it to support any number of designers and teams and products. I wish that we would have come to that realization, because when, you know, a lot of the design system headcount and vision gets talked about, we tend to hear from leadership that they may think that this is just a team that's supporting the Figma output, which is not entirely true. There's much more behind that. So I think maybe just like a leadership or stakeholder alignment would have been good there.
Yeah, I think that's, I would, my personal view is that design systems are considerably less than 50% component libraries. This is a tough topic for me, because we're focusing so much on components, because we're also trying to address immediate needs within the product. But, you know, ideally, let's imagine you're starting a design system from scratch and you're given the green light to build that strong foundation. To me, the system really shines where it's developing your experiences, laws of physics, Like this is the universe you work in. These are your constraints, so that the system is not, the system team isn't making components. It's making, not that it will, of course, but it's also developing the rules and the models and the guidelines for components to kind of design themselves. That to me is the end goal, where you've develop such strong rules and guidelines that there's only one path to the component. It's very clear that this is what it's got to be based off of all the rules. And so it's kind of on rails to a certain extent. To me, that's the ideal. But, you know, I think a lot of systems teams are got to solve problems now, right? And I get it. There are real problems and someone needs to solve them. But ideally, you'd be able to build up that strong foundation to where it kind of, a lot of it handles itself.
Yeah, I think a hurdle that we had also at Disney Streaming was there wasn't any official designer onboarding. Aside from design system onboarding, there was a little bit of like an onboarding guide, a 30-60-90 sort of approach to it, but there wasn't something that came from design ops or from design systems team to really show you Welcome to the design system. And one thing that I forgot until, you know, a few weeks ago was I used to be that person that did these ad hoc trainings where anytime I see that there's a cohort of 3 to 5 designers, I would then give them a talk on, you know, this is how you access our component libraries in abstract. This is how you, this is how they're organized. This is where we see our file and system source of truth. As time went on, there wasn't, after I stopped doing that, that was like over a year and a half ago. There hasn't been a continuation of that. So a lot of new designers do utilize office hours, but they're not coming and set up for as much success as they can, especially given that we don't have like zero height spun up yet.
We have an onboarding program within our team, and luckily just have some really great folks on the team that make that sing every 2 weeks. And it's super valuable because you're getting to leave that impression from not literally day one, but close to day one, to help build that, you know, that habit. We're hoping to build the habit that the system is a good place to start your work. And so that too, though, is a lot of work. And so we're trying to figure out how can we do that in a more efficient way. I sound like a broken record. I'm just talking about efficiency. But
well, how can you automate it, right? How can you better automate that?
Yeah, how can you put it somewhere to where people can consume it asynchronously? But you know, I mean, it's the eternal challenge that I think everyone's feeling. Like, you got so much to do, you only got so many people. You don't want to blow them up. You don't want to burn them out. So how do you do things as cost effectively as possible so you're able to get things done, but not have people turn into a puddle of goo at the end of the week? And that, funny enough, office hours and onboarding can typically be pretty time intensive efforts. Super valuable, but also really time intensive. That's a constant challenge for us.
Yeah, the split between the component libraries versus engagement, that is probably another episode in itself. One thing that's also tied to this, if we were able to measure how much, you know, theoretically how much time needs to be built into build said thing versus how much time you need to socialize and provide guidance on said thing, that also builds in a mechanism to then ask for headcount. If we say that we really do need to spin up our documentation, these are all the things that we need documented, then we could push towards getting some help on, you know, building out the documentation site for larger teams. Disney didn't have this luxury, but, you know, content designers, I think, are like a newer role, like in some of, you know, at Meta, there's a ton of them. But I think that helps quite a bit in terms of not only, you know, getting more towards real data, and then getting more towards real data that is ally and, you know, that works across multiple languages, multiple regions, that are the right type of language as well. That helps quite a bit. Speaking of ally and accessibility concern, really, even looking at the baseline of what we should be doing. So the color contrast, I think, for us is a baseline. Aria labels is... The color contrast thing, if we were able to have gotten that done as a consideration when we start. So I'm speaking more towards less of, maybe even less of color, but knowing like we should not have body copy under a certain size, and then have a very firm design system point of view on that. I think that would have helped us quite a bit.
Yeah, that, geez, accessibility is another. Today's theme is stuff we can talk about in future episodes, because that's another one where, holy moly, that is a deep dive in and of itself. And I feel like color contrast is the one everyone brings up, because it's easy to measure, like, oh, there's a ratio, you hit the ratio, you are now accessible. But there's so much more to accessibility than just that. And it is a steep, steep learning curve. I think accessibility and systems are like the best of buddies, because, you know, anytime you're dealing with a super deep topic that requires a ton of training and expertise, if you can codify that in a system and say, no, like, not that you shouldn't know this, but you probably don't have 5 years to spin up. So how about you use the system and we'll take care of 90% of it for you while you go get your doctorate in accessible design? Because it is a lot. It's a ton. And I'm learning a ton every day, because we have a lot of folks on the team that are accessibility experts. And it is clear every single day how little I know. But all the more reason why a system can be helpful, because that could be your primary focus for a feature, and that would take all your time.
Yes, like that brings up a good growth opportunity too. So we really only had one in our time working on design systems at Disney. We only had one accessibility expert that really was gung-ho, the person that we would go to. And when that person had graduated from the team, that we never got a chance to, you know, replace that. And the design system team did glean a lot of knowledge from this person, but there is the notion of the design system tertiary, you know, focus areas. So whether it's like accessibility or motion, or trying to think of a design ops, education, like there's all of these growth areas that we could utilize design systems to really have deep impact at scale. And like you mentioned a good point about, if you sort of take care of the color contrast and build that in so you don't have to worry about it. That's exactly what we had done after we didn't do it. So we figured out that a lot of our font sizes were too small early on. The contrast or the font sizes also had some issues based on using opacities of colors. We fixed that, nipped that in the butt. And now everything that comes in, like we validate that it meets AA accessibility. So that's another thing that we should feel pretty proud of as design system practitioners, that if you utilize the system, ensure that, you know, that we hit the baseline for that.
Yeah. Another thing I learned, probably the biggest learning across the board, is how much design systems can represent just pretty fundamental change for how work is done at a company. And that amount of change that you're proposing is going to take time to get buy-in. No matter how effective it is, you're talking about pretty fundamental change, and change is disruptive. It's scary. It's is this person full of it? I don't know who they are. You got to build up trust. You got to build up relationships. You got to build up some cred. It's like the metaphor of, you know, you're at home and someone knocks on your door and says, hey, yeah, so your house is completely, you know, it's broken. I can fix it for you, but I'm gonna have to take it down to the studs, and it's gonna cost you, you know, half your salary, and it's gonna take, you know, a few, you know, half a year, but it's super important, and you're gonna love it, and it's gonna be a life changing experience. And probably gonna be, who the hell are you? What the hell are you talking about? Like, I don't know you. And you know, you're effectively suggesting that at a you know, metaphorically for software. You know, like, I can, you know, this team, this thing can do all these great things, but it's gonna cost you a ton of money. It's gonna change. You gotta move out of your house for half a year. It's gonna completely change where you live. So please take this leap of faith and invest all this time and money to make this happen. It's, you know, you're expecting a lot. And so that would have been the one thing that I would have told myself, just like, this is going to take time just to get the amount of buy-in that you need to try to do the things that you want to do. And it's not because they don't understand. It's not because they disagree with you. It's just, you're proposing a lot. And it may not be the right time, or it may be that they just need to have a little bit more faith that you're the right person to do it. And just to kind of understand that there's no substitute for time in those sorts of conversations.
One of the better practices that I think led to greater adoption and greater partnerships is the notion of pair programming, pair design. And when we were federated, we did buy a lot of goodwill by working, you know, and pairing with our engineering partners. So aside from being, you know, now a horizontal design systems team, we built a lot of trust leading up to our forming of this team, because we were working with the individual contributors on the engineering side, and they knew who we were. They trusted our output. They knew we had the, for better or for worse, the best intentions for both sides. So for design engineering, and they knew that if there was any questions, we would be able to help sort of facilitate that further discussion and bring more designers into the fold. So that trust does take a while. And, you know, maybe it was because when I came to become manager, I was already, you know, I've been there for four years or so. So there was already a built-in, you know, trust there. But I do wonder, like in the situation that you have, you know, a new regime and you have new management coming in, that is probably one of the biggest hurdles, is to really come in, be empathetic and listen, and really try to understand the organization's problems before you try to, you know, flip it on its head. Yeah.
Plus you're just a trustworthy guy, Davey, just at baseline.
Trustworthy. Yeah. Got a lot of good topics for future episodes, and happy episode, you know, 10.
Oh, is that it? Oh, that's 10. Woo. Yeah,
that was 10.
So happy anniversary, Davey.
Thank you, PJ, for another spirited conversation.
Thank you, sir.